All persons having any business before this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. Please be seated.
Case number 29535, State versus Tominico. Arguing for the petitioner, Craig Jerome. Arguing for the respondent, Brian Vincent. Argument on the merits.
Good afternoon, aloha. We're very excited to be here today for oral argument at the William S. Richardson School of Law. We appreciate the law school's hospitality in having us here. So we'll be starting today with Mr. Jerome. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, and you're reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Yes, sir.
Okay, please proceed. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. I am Deputy Public Defender Craig Jerome, arguing on behalf of the petitioner, appellant, defendant, Robert Tominico in this case. Chief Justice Rechtenwald and Associate Justices of the Court. First of all, I'd like to express my appreciation for allowing me to argue Mr. Tominico's case today. I'd also like to express my gratitude to the law school for opening its doors to us and to the court for taking the time and the effort to have this argument here today. I think it's a real benefit for the law students who are in attendance. So thank you to everyone. In this case, we raised two issues in our application for writ of certiorari. The first issue was whether under State v. Wheeler, the ICA gravely erred when it held that the operating a vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant charge in this case was not fatally defective, despite the fact that it failed to include an essential element of that charge. The second issue was whether under the totality of the circumstances in this case, the ICA gravely erred in concluding that the trial court properly denied Mr. Tominico's oral motion to suppress on the date of the trial. With the court's permission, I'd like to address the suppression issue first. I feel like this is a very important case for this court to consider, but I also feel like at its heart, this is a simple and straightforward case. And it's a simple and straightforward case that calls for a simple and straightforward application of this court's longstanding search and seizure precedent that's been carefully, systematically developed over the past 40 plus years since the U.S. Supreme Court issued its decision in Terry v. Ohio. Should the court affirm the ICA's opinion in this case, I feel that it would signal a radical shift in the Article I, Section 7 jurisprudence of this state and the way that this court applies Article 1, Section 7 to investigatory stops. I feel that this case would effectively adopt the federal standard for determining whether and when a seizure has occurred. This is despite the fact that the federal standard was conclusively and soundly rejected by this court almost 20 years ago in State v. Kennedy.
I know you want to start with a motion to suppress, but your application states that your cert request is based only on, I guess, count one of the complaint.
That charge.
So, and you note that counts two and three were dismissed. Am I correct?
That's correct.
So, if counts two and three were dismissed, what does that mean for this case?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure that I understand the question.
Well, the prosecution makes the argument that under Elliott, if, for example, in count one, the term operate is not defined, then you can refer to other counts to determine that operate means operating on a public road. Do you call that?
Yes, sure.
So you would need to look to count three in order to determine that term operate in count one is operate on a public road.
That's correct, Your Honor. Count three is the no more.
So counts two and three were dismissed, and what does that mean for this case?
Well, I think that you raise a good point, which is that at that point, I don't think we can look to counts two and three to fill in sort of the missing element from count one, which is the OBUII charge. I suppose there's an argument to be made because there was a written complaint filed in this case, and counts two and three were part of the written complaint, you could still look to counts two and three because under the liberal construction standard, I guess effectively you're allowed to consider everything that's been provided to the defendant up until the point when he raises the issue of sufficiency.
Is that your position?
Our position is that we would concede that it appears that the liberal construction standard applies in this case because it wasn't raised until the appeal. And I think that Wheeler makes it fairly clear that that's the situation. The distinction I would make is that because counts two and three were dismissed, and he's orally charged only under count one at that point, that is the charge we're looking at this case.
The court dismissed counts two and three before even doing the motion to suppress or the trial, isn't that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So at that point, there was only count one, right? And he was only orally charged on count one.
That's correct, Your Honor. And we would argue that count one is fatally defective because it's missing that what Wheeler says is an essential element, which is that the attendant circumstance that the conduct took place upon a public way, road, street, or highway. I think I got them in the right order, but I'm not sure. But
so I'm trying to determine whether if counts two and three are no longer in the charge, then how would you be able to qualify or define the term operating in count one?
We would argue that you can't. That at that point, count one is fatally defective. The charge in this case is fatally defective, and the trial court was without jurisdiction at that point to entertain the motion to suppress or the trial that happened subsequent to the motion to suppress. So we are asking this court to reverse the ICA's decision that concluded that the count wasn't fatally defective and to dismiss the charge against Mr. Tominico because the complaint was defective.
Counsel, doesn't Wheeler talk in terms of providing notice as a matter of due process to the defendant? This case, would the defendant have gotten notice both through those dismissed counts as well as through the police report, as well as through the oral testimony of the suppression hearing, which identified the car as being parked on the side of the street?
Well, Wheeler does talk about providing notice to the defendant, but Wheeler also talks about the fact that a defective complaint is an issue of jurisdiction pursuant to State v. Cummings. And Wheeler says it's well settled that an accusation must sufficiently allege all of the essential elements of the offense charged. Put differently, the sufficiency of the charging instrument is measured inter alia by whether it contains the elements of the offense intended to be charged and sufficiently apprises the defendant of what he or she must be prepared to meet. So we would argue that it's a requirement that it has to contain both all of the essential elements and has to provide notice to the defendant of basically what the factual allegations of the charge are. And going back to State v. Elliott, which Justice Okover brought up, I think that there's a lot of attention paid in the examination of State v. Elliott as far as the assault against a law enforcement officer charge goes, with looking to the resisting arrest charge in that case to try to fill in the missing parts of basically the facts that are missing from the assault against a law enforcement officer charge. But it's also important to note in that case that the court held that the resisting arrest charge was defective because it failed to include an essential element, which is the intent element. So I have a problem with looking to other counts in a complaint or an indictment to fill in missing elements of a charge. I think that all the case law that I've been able to find on this, I don't think there's ever a case where there's an essential element missing that's borrowed from another charge. For instance, you couldn't borrow the intent element from one charge and use it to supply that missing element in another charge. So we would argue that because there's a missing element from the OBUIA charge, even if you consider counts two and three, there's still the count one is still fatally defective for failing to allege that essential element of the charge.
What about the discovery of the trial evidence? Can that be considered? Certainly put him on notice that he was being accused of having operated a vehicle or parked his vehicle next to a public street.
I would say it puts him on notice of what the state's going to allege the facts are, but I think the important part of requiring the complaint or the charge or the count to include all of the essential elements is that it gives notice of the defendant of what the state is going to be required to prove in order to find him guilty of the offense that he's being charged with, and what some of his potential defenses to that charge may be. So if there's nothing in the OBUII charge about public way, road, street, or highway, the defendant, as a person of common understanding, may not realize that that's not a defense, that that would provide him a defense to the charge, that the state would be required to prove that he was, in fact, upon a public way, street, road, or highway during the trial.
If I might interrupt, Mr. Jerome, isn't there kind of a common sense element to this also, that all three paragraphs pertain to the same incident that happened, I believe it was the same day, same month, and whatever, all of the events that are recounted in the first three paragraphs relate to that same incident. Isn't there some common sense we should apply when we look to see it?
I mean, I think the common sense application says that this is the conduct that's being charged against the defendant, that it's pretty apparent to the defendant that all three of these charges probably arise from the same incident, and that the conduct in one count is alleging that he was on a public, I'm just going to say public road because it's getting complicated to keep saying it. I'm afraid I'm not saying it the right way every time, but that he's not on a public road. The problem is in this case, there's three counts. The first count, the OBUII count, doesn't have the essential element. And Wheeler says it's an essential element of the charge that must be alleged, that he operated on a public road. Count two is the driving while license is suspended or revoked for DUI, which also contains the term operate from 291E1, does not contain the upon a public road language. So count two would also be, if it had been charged and gone to trial, I would also argue would be fatally defective in this case. And in count three, the no motor vehicle insurance contains the upon a public road language. So he knows, the defendant knows, hey, if I can prove that I wasn't on a public road, I can be found not guilty of the no insurance charge. But he doesn't know that's a defense to the first two charges, even though it is. And when the no insurance charge is dismissed prior to trial, he doesn't know why that is. And now he doesn't even have that charge to look at in terms of trying to determine and figure out what the elements are of the offense he's being charged with and what the possible defenses are to that offense.
So it's your position that the purpose of the charge is to advise the defendant's defenses as opposed to what he's accused of having done?
My position is that case law in this jurisdiction says the charging document has to allege all of the essential elements of the offense. It also has to sufficiently apprise him of what he or she needs to be prepared to meet. I would say that each count needs to do both of those things, and that you can't borrow essential elements from one count to fill in elements that are missing from another count. Let's say the defendant is charged with three counts, which are where the intent is intentional or knowing. One of those counts is missing the intentional or knowing language, and the other two contain the intentional or knowing language. I would say you can't borrow the intentional or knowing from the one count to fill in for the mistake that was made in the first count.
Was there any prejudice to the defendant for this alleged deceptive charge?
I don't think there's any evidence on the record that he was prejudiced by the charge. I don't think I can stand here before this court and make an argument that he was prejudiced by the absence of the language in the charge, which means that this court under Mata Wells needs to look at whether the count can otherwise within reason be construed to charge an offense. And we would argue because the essential element is missing, it can't be construed to charge an offense. We would argue that a count is always fatally defective if it fails to allege an essential element of the charge.
If the count is supposed to satisfy two things, one is that a necessary element is contained in the charge to satisfy the requirement that the court has jurisdiction That would be one aspect of what has to be satisfied by charge.
That's correct.
The other part of charge has to at least inform the defendant of what he would be charged, what he's being charged for, so that he can mount a defense, i.e. it's notice of what he's being charged for.
That's correct.
That's the due process requirement.
That's correct, Your Honor. And
so when you talk about the missing element being supplied by matters outside of the charge itself, are we talking about the jurisdictional aspect, the jurisdictional requirement, or are we talking about the process requirement?
I believe that it's mainly about the jurisdictional element, although I believe there are also some due process concerns that are raised. I think that in looking at the cases in the fact that have come out of the courts in the past, I think that sometimes it's talked about it as a jurisdictional issue, and sometimes it's talked about it as a notice issue. And I think there's some overlap there, but I think the essential elements being alleged is more of a jurisdictional issue because...
Well, the distinction is key, right? Because if the requirement is a jurisdictional one, and that's not met, it doesn't matter whether the defendant, in fact, knew what the charges were against him or what the facts were as against him.
That's correct, Your
Honor. We've said that. This court has said that. It doesn't matter whether there's prejudice, no prejudice, or what the defendant knew. If you don't satisfy the jurisdictional requirement of stating an element.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that goes back to the two prongs of the Mata Wells liberal construction analysis are, even if there's no prejudice, if the charge doesn't charge an offense within reason, there's no jurisdiction. So it doesn't matter any longer if the defendant has notice or is prejudiced by the failure to allege an offense. Because I believe it goes back to the idea that if the charge is defective, it's not charging an offense under the Hawaii Penal Code, and the court doesn't have jurisdiction to hear charges that are invalid under the Hawaii Penal Code. And looking at the other case law that's come out, as I said, the other cases, it's not supplying missing elements of offenses. In Schroeder, it's the issue is whether or not this aggravating element of a gun being included in the kidnapping charge was alleged, and they said that the robbery charge does that, but you know it's not a missing element itself from the kidnapping charge. We already talked about Elliot. Mata, the burglary 2 charge, in Mata, there's not a missing element as far as the fact that he had to enter the building with intent to commit a crime therein. The issue was whether the charging document was required to specify what crime it was that he was accused of committing or having the intent to commit within the building. So,
Mr. Jerome, are you saying that the written complaint, as it stood when it was filed, that the defendant can prove that the complaint cannot be reasonably interpreted to charge a crime?
I believe the complaint can be reasonably interpreted to charge the no motor vehicle insurance crime because that's, in my opinion, that's the only count on that charge that's not fatally defective for failing to allege an essential element of the crime.
So you don't agree that we can look at other counts in a written complaint to look at the documents?
I mean, the case law is clear that the court can look at other counts or other information that's supplied to the defendant, but the question is whether that looking at other counts becomes a question of sufficiently apprising him of the facts and the circumstances of the case, or whether looking at those other charges, those other counts, you're able to borrow elements of the offense from those other counts in order to substitute for missing elements of the other counts in the charging document. And the problem with that is that then it's going to be, I mean, how is the defendant supposed to figure out what elements to take from one count to move into another count? I mean, this charging documents are intended so that people of ordinary understanding can understand what they're being charged with and to ensure that courts have jurisdiction over criminal offenses.
So can you reasonably argue that Mr. Tomiko did to not know he was being charged driving a motor car while intoxicated on a public road.
Well, the issue, I would argue, is not whether or not he was prejudiced by the failure to allege the essential element.
I guess the question, I thought you just said that the reasonable person couldn't understand what the charge was. I mean, we're assuming Mr. Truman is a reasonable person. So a reasonable person would understand the charge. That's the standard.
Well, I don't know if a reasonable person could read that charge and understand that upon a public way, road, street, or highway is an essential element of the offense of operating a vehicle under the influence of an intoxicant, which in fact, until State v. Wheeler was decided, most people weren't sure that that was an element of the offense or not.
Mr. Jerome, would you like to address the suppression issue? You have 5 minutes left.
I would like to address the suppression issue because I feel that even if this court decides that the charge is fatally defective in this case, I think that suppression issue still needs to be addressed. I won't go into a long recitation of the facts in this case. I don't think they're really in dispute. And what the facts that are in the IC opinion are accurate as far as I can tell. The first issue in any suppression issue is when was Mr. Tominico seized? At what point was he seized? Was he seized? And we would argue that Mr. Tominico is seized at the point at which Officer Stewart, we would argue that he's seized at the first point when Officer Stewart comes up to him, starts asking him questions, and asks to see his identification. But at the very least, I believe that once Mr. Tominico enters his car, Officer Stewart attempts to stop the motor vehicle. I believe that under Kipi and Elenicki, that's a seizure. It's axiomatic that a seizure of passenger vehicle and detaining its occupants is a seizure under Hawaii case law. And a reasonable person in Mr. Tominico's circumstance would not have believed at that point that he was free to leave. The next issue is whether or not the officer had reasonable suspicion that Mr. Tominico was involved in criminal activity at the time at which he was seized. And the lead opinion in this case seems to leave it at reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot at the time of the seizure. And we would argue that the reasonable suspicion has to be that criminal activity involving Mr. Tominico was afoot. And I think that's the step that's missing in the lead opinion. And the concurring opinion, I believe, actually gets that right here. The issue I have with both the lead opinion and the concurring opinion, and this is where we get back to Kino, is they seem to suggest that because Mr. Tominico did not stop when the officer was trying to stop him, he was not seized at that point, and he's not seized until this car coming in the other direction stops him from proceeding forward. And when the officer goes up at that point and sees open containers in his car, that somehow gives him RS at that point to stop Mr. Tominico. That's separate and distinct.
Counsel argues that there was enough information because of a large crowd, loud noise, people drinking in the crowd, to give the police officer reasonable suspicion, the defendant being part of the crowd, to stop the defendant. And I believe that reasonable suspicion did exist, that a crime was, or criminal activity was afoot.
The way I read the situation is Officer Stewart arrives at the scene. There's 15 or somewhere between 12 and 20 people gathered at the scene. They all start kind of digging out when Officer Stewart gets there. They start leaving in a hurry. Officer Stewart admits that at this point, there are people in the crowd that are drinking. It appears to be a social gathering. Officer Stewart admits, however, that Mr. Tominico has nothing in his hands. He's not drinking. He's not arguing with anybody. He's not fighting with anybody. He's not engaged in anything that would give a reasonable person specific and articulable facts that he himself is involved in criminal activity. Could Officer Stewart have stopped some people in the crowd? Absolutely. But if there's 15 people driving down the highway and 7 of those people are speeding and driving recklessly, swerving all over the road, that doesn't give an officer reasonable suspicion to stop the other 8 people who are driving within the bounds of the law.
What do you think about Judge Nakamura's concurring where he feels that the stop was actually made by somebody else.
What Judge Nakamura's concurring opinion does respectfully is adopts the federal standard, which is that a person is not seized until the police either use physical force, no matter how slight, to stop that person, or the person submits to the police officer's show of authority. Keno and Kachanian make it clear that if a reasonable person in the defendant's position would not have felt that he or she was free to leave the scene, and he or she attempts to leave the scene, they are still seized. They're seized at the moment when a reasonable person would not feel free to leave the scene, and they're seized up until the point when a reasonable person would feel free to leave the scene.
So let's assume that he was seized and that there was reasonable suspicion. I'll just finish this question very quickly. How is it that the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine would apply here? In what way did the police exploit any illegality in that initial seizure? And didn't the officer just walk up to the car and look inside to see the bottles 7 feet down the road?
Did, but at that point, the seizure is already invalid. So that's fruit of the poisonous tree, the fact that he saw the bottle, the fact that they do the field sobriety test,
But he drove away. It wasn't the officer ordering him to stop that caused him to stop. He, in fact, drove away until he was confronted by another car.
He did drive away, but he's already seized at that point, whether or not he submits to the officer's authority or not. The fact that he drives 7 feet away from where the officer is yelling at him to stop and telling him to turn off the car and get out of the car, that doesn't somehow remove the taint of the original seizure. I mean, that's the federal standard. And, you know, in 1992, this court in State v. Keno said, we're not adopting the federal standard, we're adopting the Mendenhall standard, which is that you're seized at the moment when a reasonable person would not feel free to leave the scene, so on. Into my rebuttal time.
Hold on to you a little.
Thank you.
Mr. Vincent?
Thank
you. Good afternoon. May it please the court. Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Brian Vincent on behalf of the state of Hawaii. As I was listening to you, I think it's important to differentiate. There's two reasons why we have to complain. I think they require different analysis. First one is the constitutional notice requirement, the accused has to be informed of the nature and cause of the action against him, or the accusation against him. That's a constitutional right, and that can be waived, and it's also subject to harmless error analysis. The other reason you have a complaint is to inform the court whether or not they have jurisdiction of this particular case. I don't think the defendant is saying in this case that he didn't have notice of the nature and cause of that condition. In this modern day, when we have appointed trial attorneys, every defendant has a right to a trial, to a counsel appointed to them by the state. You have statutory law where everything's in writing in the statutes. You have Westlaw, you can look up all the cases. And public defenders are not by any means ineffective, okay? They know what the elements of the charge of over the UI is. And if they thought that it did not happen on a public street, it would certainly. I'll bring that up.
So the Elliott case seems to suggest that it's appropriate to look at counts other than counts.
That's correct. And Schroeder as well.
But in this case, the other two counts were dismissed after the initial written charge was filed. Is there, in your mind, does the court somehow lose jurisdiction after it initially had it, or what was your analysis of that issue?
Well, I don't know why the driving while license suspended for OVUI was dismissed, but the defendant charge we're concerned with, the new insurance charge, was dismissed for good faith defense. So it was not dismissed because we didn't have jurisdiction. It was dismissed because the defendant was not the registered owner of the vehicle. Okay, so I don't think that would indicate that it did not happen on a public street.
Mr. Jerome makes a distinction between our case, or this case, and State v. Schroeder, because in State v. Schroeder, it was a failure to charge our attorney instructions. And this is a failure to charge.
Well, I think attendance circumstance is an element. It should be defined as an element. So, in the case, I guess Schroeder did charge a charge, but it didn't charge the charge for which the sentence, it increased the maximum sentence, right? So I think it would.
Mr. Ritson, then you draw the distinction. I agree with you that the other aspect of the charge is that it has to state all the elements of the offense.
Well, I don't, it's unclear to me from the case law.
Okay, let's assume that.
Whether under the model wells liberal construction standard, you have to do that.
All right. Let's assume that we're looking at a charge. The charge is that the charge has to include all the elements of the offense.
Well, if it was objected to, immediately
when it's filed.
Yeah, when it was filed. Then I would say that would be a facial challenge to the charge, and I think it would have a good argument that it should be dismissed at that time. I think that you can consider the companion charges that are filed at the same time.
If the element is not stated in the charge, then that's a jurisdictional defect and the charge has to be dismissed.
If that was the only charge that was charged in this case.
And that's you, basically, right?
That's correct. If it was made at the time, in a timely fashion.
And so, when we come to, the point after trial, I guess you can make the argument that this is raised after trial and not raised before trial, this supposed insufficiency of the charge, that you can look at the complaint and try to reasonably construe that an offense is stated.
I'll go further than that. I would say that once the defendant has failed to make a facial challenge to the complaint at the time it's filed, then I think they waived that opportunity to make a facial challenge, and now they have to make a factual challenge.
Okay.
So that the court has to consider everything that's in front of it up to the time that the challenge is made.
Okay. Although I'm not sure that I see that in any of our cases. But in Mota, there's no prejudice in this case. The court would need to determine whether or not what's left can be reasonably construed as an offense.
In Mota or in this case. Okay.
And so Elliot says, in order to do that, you can look at other parts of the charge for the complaint.
Yeah, well,
and that's where it comes to whether we can consider counts 2 and 3 and construe count 1. Right. You make that argument in your brief.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So if that's the case, if before anything starts in this trial, before even the motion to suppress, the court dismisses counts 2 and 3. So counts 2 and 3 are no longer there. What's left to be construed with count 1?
I don't think that once the court has jurisdiction, that it's automatically divested of its jurisdiction simply by the dismissing of the counts. Furthermore, at the motion to suppress, we introduced evidence this incident happened on Ahanui Street, right? And according to State v. West, we have to recognize all the ordinances. And one of the ordinances is that they have speed schedules for speeds on public roads, right? And on Schedule 4, which was construed as ordinance in West, Schedule 4 Ahanui Street was listed as one of the streets. The public street. So I think in West, this court said that this court is duty bound to recognize ordinances. So I think that whenever you see in suppression hearing, whenever you see the statement that that happened on Ahanui Street, I think you can interpolate that happened on a public street. And the defendant does not deny that it happened on public street. It happened on Ahanui Street in particular.
Are you saying then that as long as the charge says it happened on a certain street, that the charge itself doesn't have to say it happened on a public street or the operation of the vehicle is not on a public street?
What this court has said as recently as in State v. Hitchcock, it said that when deciding whether a charge is adequate, it would look to all the information supplied to the defendant by the state to the point where the court passes upon the contention that the right has been violated. So in this case, the court did not, judiciary did not pass on this until it reached the ICA. So I think you've got to look at the entire record to determine whether or not the district court in this case actually had jurisdiction.
Mr. Vincent, can I ask you about the search and seizure?
Okay.
When do you think Mr. Kilmeny was seized?
Well, I don't think this case is Keno, for starters. But Keno, we had a walk and talk case, right? Where a police officer went out to the airport. They apparently picked some flights from what they call as source cities, right? And they were just randomly, well, not maybe not randomly, they were just stopping people that looked suspicious, right? Okay, and they were coming off the plane, asked to see their plane tickets.
And they hadn't done anything wrong.
No, they had not done anything
wrong.
Well, I think Prince Gonzalez is a good point. The officer had not seen him drinking, right? And hadn't seen him fighting, hadn't seen him making personal noise, but he had seen the group making noise. Okay, I mean, he arrived at Ahanui North School Street because he had received a complaint of loud noise and possible fighting at this particular location at this particular time, which was, by the way, midnight. It's not part of the record, but it's a residential neighbor. So as soon as he stepped out of the car, well, as soon as he arrived on the scene, he already has this report, right? As soon as he steps out of his car, he hears loud noise, and he sees alcohol beverages, containers around, beer bottles. And to compound it, and I'm not saying this is determinative, but everybody starts dispersing, right? Okay, so it's one factor, and so I think it was not unreasonable for the officer at this point in time to ask somebody for their ID, ask them what's going on. I don't think that we even get to the. I disagree with Chief Judge Matt Nakamura. I don't believe that you have to have reasonable suspicion as to a particular individual in a group. If you establish the group possibly like being involved in a unlawful behavior, I don't think you have to establish reasonable suspicion for each person in that group before you approach it.
But wouldn't you agree it's unlikely that the one person that didn't run away would be the one that would be accused of some criminal activity?
He wasn't running away. He wasn't able to run as fast as the other people.
I'm sure that's in the record.
And he was unlucky in the fact that he went to his car instead of walking off down the street. I mean, he may have just been cited for possibly drinking in public, maybe not even that, okay? If he hadn't gotten in his car and driven off.
Well, it seems to me from your briefs, I jumped at a conclusion, but you seem to agree that the first stop, I think your theory is there were two stops, that the first stop may have been an improper, illegal seizure, but that the second one was somehow independent of that, and that's when he saw the open beer bottles in the back seat.
My position has always been that the first stop, he had reasonable suspicion initially to simply ask him for his ID and to ask him what was going on. My fallback position was that police officer didn't actually stop him, okay, because the defendant did not comply. Right?
Well, so, assuming you're arguing that the first stop was illegal, is there any way that somehow can be cured in the second event, that the illegal seizure becomes a legal one?
Well, I think that, under the open view doctrine, an officer has, if the officer sees evidence of an unlawful activity and from a viewpoint, it's a public viewpoint, he has a right to, that can form a basis for reasonable suspicion, right? And in this case, I don't see, what would have stopped the officer from?
Maybe we should just, it could help us on the facts. There was an initial, there was a stop, the officer directed the defendant to stop while he was in his car, correct?
That's correct. Okay.
And the defendant then drove away, is that right?
That's correct.
And then the defendant was stopped. Was he stopped by the officer or was he stopped by something else?
He was stopped by an unrelated vehicle. It was, I don't know which direction he was pulling from, but apparently he blocked his way. He could not proceed. The defendant could not proceed.
And it was at that point then that the officer observed in the back seat his body.
Yeah, the officer was still walking towards the driver's side window, right? And he looks in the back seat. So
the bottles were in plain view.
That's correct.
Okay, so in what way did the officer exploit any illegality? If you assume arguendo that the initial stop, the direction to the defendant to stop back while he was parked in his car was unlawful, there wasn't reasonable suspicion. In what way, if any, was that illegality exploited by the officer in this case?
I don't think it was. I don't think there was, even if you assume it's illegal, I don't think that there was any, there was independent intervening factors there.
When was the first stop?
Well, assuming it's a stop.
Well, when did you say the first stop? When was the first stop?
I mean, Kino seems to suggest that as soon as you accost anybody, okay, that's the beginning of the stop. That's the seizure there.
I don't know if Kino is really involved in this case, but when do you? At what point do you say it was the stop, the first stop?
Well, I would say the stop happened after he saw the empty beer bottle and the passengers.
So, your position is that when he tells the defendant to get out of the car, that's not his issue?
He tells him to get out of the car, but doesn't comply.
He doesn't comply, but he tells us to get out of the car.
That's correct.
And under our test, well, what's the test for a seizure?
I guess we're sitting in Mendenhall, and I guess I'm not familiar with the specific facts of Mendenhall, but I guess in a case like Kino, it's when you accost them. I mean, that's I guess violates their right to privacy when they get off.
Just a simple question. What's the test for seizure?
I'm afraid I couldn't focus.
You read Kino?
Yeah, I read Kino. Yes.
Haven't we held, Mr. Vincent, that a traffic stop is a form of seizure for constitutional purposes?
Definitely, yeah. But in any case, my first position is that the original initial command to stop was justified by reasonable suspicion. So
you base that reasonable suspicion on what was observed before the officer got up and talked to the
That's right. Yeah. Noise complaints, seeing beer bottles, hearing loud noise when you got there.
What was the actual criminal activity that he was being looked at and examined for?
HRS 711-1101 has a engaging in fighting or threatening or in a violent, tumultuous behavior, disorderly conduct, or making unreasonable noise.
And doesn't the record indicate that the police officer did not remember seeing defendant drinking or with a beer in his hand?
I don't think that defendant, until he started approaching the crowd and everybody managed to get away faster than the defendant, I don't think he particularly identified any particular person in the crowd. I think there was 12 people, but I've heard maybe as much as 20, possibly. There's a lot of people there. He just wants to find out what's going on.
He just wants to nail somebody.
Well, he wants to find out what's going on. He wants to make sure they can find out.
I think the officer said it was like a pot shop. There's a lot of food. Use the word pot.
Yeah, I don't know.
We saw that.
This is the public sidewalk.
So he didn't see any argument. He didn't see any fight.
You heard loud noise. You heard loud.
He couldn't say that it was an argument.
He didn't say that. He didn't say it was. He didn't say. He never said he saw any fighting. He saw any
theaters, which was. And he didn't say he saw any argument. I heard any argument.
The other one is other statute that they would be violating.
He didn't say there was any argument.
What
did the defendant do that was criminal activity or indicated that criminal activity was?
Well, the group was definitely. He had reasonable suspicion to believe that members of the group were drinking alcoholic beverage in public place, which is in violation of revised ordinances. So section 40-1.2.
As one of the persons drinking. He was asked, wasn't he?
I don't think there's a lot of people there. I don't think he had a time to identify a particular person as one person drinking. Other person not drinking.
Stopping a crowd, stopping an individual. Yeah. Under Terry, you have to have reasonable suspicion to believe that the individual stopped who's engaging that type of criminal activity.
Well, our safe position is that the officer has to have some latitude when they're dealing with large group factors. Making this officer wait around until everybody disperses before they. And empowered to go up and ask what's going on public sidewalk is too restrictive. That's our position.
So. Is there anything in the record about who called in the complaint? Do we know anything about tips or?
Well, I don't know if it was anonymous, but it was not part of the record as to who called in the complaint. The residential neighborhood.
The residential neighborhood, it could have been somebody just upset with the noise outside their home.
It could, but when he got out of the car, certain details were confirmed, the fact that they were making quite a bit of noise. Plus the additional fact that there was a 50 beer bottle.
Also, it was at the end of this incident, was it not, that this officer observed open bottles in the backseat of the defendant's car, plaintiff. In other words, he didn't enter the car, he saw them from outside the car. And did the trial court make any findings at all as to whether the officer's ability to look inside the car at that moment was in any way causally related to the prior stop, which I would ask you to assume was not based on reasonable suspicion. Are there any findings in the record as to whether the ultimate observation by the officer of the bottles on the backseat of the car were in any way causally related to any illegality that occurred earlier in this transaction?
Well, I mean, that was just.
Did the court make any findings?
As causal relation as this, was this an indication of other things that you were doing at the time?
The defendant argues the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine.
Right, okay.
Under the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine, in the defendant's view, because there was an illegal stop, that things that happened after that stop were also suppressed and are unlawful. The question I have is, did the court in any way make findings with regard to the applicability of that doctrine in the circumstances? this case?
I don't recall him making any specific findings as to whether or not it was clearly the fruit of the poison is true. The general.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
When the officer told the defendant to stop, the defendant drove a little bit, about 7 feet, but couldn't leave any further because the car blocked his way.
That's correct.
Why couldn't the defendant reverse backwards?
I could tell you why I thought because he's impaired, okay? He's probably a little bit slow. The officer is telling him to stop. He's walking without responding. I mean, but as far as the officer, what the officer said, I think that the officer was walking alongside the car, up on the driver's side window.
The felon's brief says that the officer pulled his car behind the defendant's vehicle and blocked the street. Is that something in the statement?
You know, I don't know. There was a couple of different things in the record. I had thought that the police officer was parked across the street on the other side of the North School Street. That's if I'm wrong in that. The defendant may have been concerned that if he backed up, it falls. Do you have any more questions you want to ask me for this charging issue? Good, thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. General.
Thank you. I'm not sure how much time I have left, but there were a couple of things that came out during Mr. Vincent's argument that I'd like to address. The first question is whether or not the officer is allowed to just stop anybody in this group where certain individuals are maybe engaged in criminal activity and other individuals are not. I think that the case law is pretty clear that there has to be reasonable suspicion that criminal activity involving the defendant is afoot, not that there's just general criminal activity in the area. In order to stop somebody under Elinecki, the court says you have to have reasonable suspicion that the defendant is engaged in criminal activity, is about to be engaged in criminal activity, or is wanted for previously engaging in criminal activity. The other thing is the officer, just like any other citizen, is free at this point in time to go up to individuals who are on the scene and ask them for information, ask them what's going on, ask if anybody's arguing. The problem in this case is when Mr. Tominico, as is his right under a citizen, refuses to participate in that interrogation and attempts to leave the scene, Officer Stewart detains him. He stops him forcibly.
So let's assume that's right. In fact, it was a stop that wasn't based on reasonable suspicion. When the defendant drove away and then his car was blocked by another vehicle, in what way did the police officer exploit any illegality in that initial stop in order to put himself in a position to then view the bottles and claim through the vaccine in his car? What was the exploitation of the illegality that we require under the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine in this case?
Okay, and this is another point I wanted to make. Is people are talking about the first stop and the initial stop and the second stop. It's all one stop in this case. There is no first stop and no second stop. The other thing is that it's all exploiting the illegality of the original search, because the officer has no right and no purpose in continuing to pursue Mr. Tominico at that point.
He has a right to be standing on the sidewalk looking in the car. He has a right to be outside the car looking in if that's what he chooses.
He does, in the same way that the officers in Kachanian and the officers in Kino had the right to be in the airport and see when the defendants in those cases ditched drugs and sought and made them so that they were in plain view of the officers.
I asked Mr. Vincent what the test was for a seizure, and he didn't give us an answer. What is the test for a seizure?
The test for a seizure is when, under the totality of the circumstances, from an objective viewpoint, if the person in the a reasonable person in the defendant's position would have believed that he or she was not free to disregard the inquiries and leave.
Was not free to leave, right?
Yes. Okay.
So when the officer asked the defendant to exit the vehicle, that point, would a reasonable person believe that she was not going to?
I know you're
right. Okay. And so when the defendant didn't exit the vehicle, and started to drive away for, I guess, some 7 feet, the officer pursued him.
That's correct. Sure.
I mean, he didn't just walk up. He had to come alongside and pursue him. And that was, I guess, I would assume, under the facts, part of his initial order to exit the vehicle.
That's correct. I mean, the phrase that's used in Kachanian, I believe, is that the officer keeps the defendant on an investigatory tether. He never ceases trying to pursue the defendant in order to stop him. So
if the officer were attempting to pursue the, was pursuing the defendant, would it make any difference how the defendant eventually came to a stop?
I would say no, Your Honor, whether it's traffic or a red light or stop sign or he gets into an accident, it's all the actual physical act that causes him to stop moving his vehicle, I don't think is relevant.
Your time's up.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you, counsel. And we'll take this matter under advisement.
Please rise. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii stands adjourned until further notice.